the case of the like three cases pretty much in one. Do you expect three briefs for that, or the
Rollins versus Fletcher? You could probably do that in the form of one brief for the whole case, because it's basically in three different stages of trial, appeal, further appeal, and so you're dealing with the same facts, and that makes it relatively easy.
Is this English law that we're studying?
You mean in that particular case or in general?
Well, what's the relationship with the English law system and our system?
I wouldn't have to make a case for the relevance of Rylands versus Fletcher, thanks to Sigler versus Kuhlman, which in part relies upon Rylands versus Fletcher in imposing liability for an abnormally dangerous activity. It raises the sort of larger question about what matters to a court. What are the sources of authority that a court will rely upon to reach its decision? And I think the best sort of analogy to understand a court's method of looking for authority is the concept of gravity. That is, the moon exerts some gravitational pull on the Earth, but not as much of a gravitational pull as the sun. But the sun's farther away, but the sun's very big. So when you're for example, the state of Washington deciding Sigler versus Kuhlman, where do you look for authority? Well, the most authoritative in terms of the thing you cannot disobey would be the United States Supreme Court's interpretation of some constitutional provision. If they've decided an issue, you're compelled to follow it. Probably the second most important source of authority would be your own state constitution, and then previous cases of the Washington Supreme Court, prior precedent. But as you move further away from these kind of big sources of authority, you wind up with, for example, the decision of a sister state. What did the Supreme Court of Oregon decide? And oftentimes you have conflicting authorities. You have a footnote in a 1930s case that makes some reference to your problem, but it doesn't directly decide the issue. You have a very relevant decision of a sister court, but it doesn't have any binding precedential value. So typically when a court is caught in a case where there are competing arguments for how to decide it, authorities of different levels of persuasiveness become useful. Now, the English law, some of it is very old, and because it's very old, cases like Vaughan versus Menlove, or we'll find even older cases as we go along, sometimes they have addressed an issue in a way that had a kind of sort of set the course for subsequent development of the law in that area. And its ancient pedigree has a kind of authority of its own. By contrast, of course, you can find that society has changed, or the law has changed, or the principle has been abandoned or modified in some way. But again, in trying to get the court to rule in your favor, you may look to a variety of different sources of authority which aren't binding on the court, but which either state the issue very well, provide persuasive argument in your favor, or represent the opinion of some substantial body of people who who, you know, gee, if all these people think this way, it's going to influence me in the direction of going along with that. So, again, English cases appear. In Chapter 3, for example, when we come to the issue of wrongful death, the United States Supreme Court, in looking at Moraine versus State Marine Lines, goes all the way back to English common law prior to the, you know, the formation of the American colonies, and how the law of wrongful death developed in England and was then imported to the United States, and what relevance that had, and how it affects the concept of, you know, whether or not Congress wanted to or did create a remedy for wrongful death. So, again, sort of the status of English law. Okay, let's finish up with Sigler versus Coleman, because there's the I hope, even though we covered it in a relatively accelerated fashion, the standard used by the court, the restatement test, is one that is widely followed in American courts. Really, the criteria for abnormally dangerous activities, those criteria are pretty much accepted. Their application, of course, would require some debate and thinking as to how a particular case ought to be characterized, whether falling within or falling outside of its definition of what is an abnormally dangerous activity. The other thing you want to bear in mind are the limitations, or the limitation in Section 519, which says that only those things, only those accidents that reflect the abnormally dangerous character of the activity are subject to strict liability. So again, if the guy in the tanker truck runs over somebody on a bicycle, the defendant would not be held to a standard of strict liability. It may be that the defendant was negligent in running over the guy on a bicycle, but the plaintiff would have to prove negligence in order to recover. It's only when the gasoline spills and the thing that makes it abnormally dangerous, the flammability of the contents, only when that causes the injury would you have the basis for imposing strict liability.
Could you give us a couple other examples of cases that are abnormally dangerous?
Oh,
so I just want to get a picture of what else is fitting in the category.
Well, the explosives, obviously, you know, something like the Judson versus Giant Powder Company. That's a classic case of something that's abnormally dangerous. Highly toxic chemicals, or certainly radioactive chemicals, would fall within that definition. You know, carrying large quantities of sulfuric acid, or you know, carrying on an operation that involves you know, very poisonous chemicals. All these sorts of things would be. And again, in the previous exams, I'm trying to think of ones that have popped up on previous exams, where the court treated them as falling within that category. And I can't think of any that come to mind right away.
Fireworks.
In fact, that's one of the cases cited in the notes. Somebody's operating a fireworks display. Here we are coming up on the 4th of July. One of these fireworks went astray and injured somebody, and the court said, well, that's an activity that's abnormally dangerous. Okay, now again, the concurring opinion accepts the idea of strict liability, but agrees that in this case it applies, but the concurring opinion is what is known as a special concurrence, because it sort of offers thoughts on something that isn't immediately at hand, but says, you know, I agree with the reasoning of the majority, but they didn't say something which I think needs to be said. So we should review that. Is it Ms. Goel? Is that how you say her name?
Yeah.
What's Rossellini's point in the concurrence in Sigler? Why does he write a separate opinion instead of simply adding his name to the majority opinion? Okay. He wants to clarify. He's letting us know that if the facts were different, if this accident were caused by the negligence of a third party, that would affect his belief that strict liability should be applied. So let's assume, for purposes of discussion, that we've got this truck rolling down the highway carrying 10,000 gallons of gasoline. Now, in the facts of Sigler, it overturns for reasons not entirely clear and causes the fire. But Rossellini is imagining a case where some third party, let's say another car on the highway, makes a sudden lane change, and the truck tries to avoid colliding with him, and in trying to avoid it, the truck overturns, and we have this fire, and the plaintiff gets injured. What does Rossellini say should be the legal treatment of that kind of case? Okay, he says it would be different with respect to strict liability that the accident was not caused solely by the abnormally dangerous character of this activity, but was a combination of the highly volatile, flammable nature of gasoline combined with the negligence of a third party. Why should that make a difference? Why does it make a difference to Rossellini if it's a deer or, you know, something else that causes this collision as opposed to another driver? Does he explain that? Well, you could go that way, but one of the things we have to bear in mind is the fact that there is no requirement of showing that the defendant's action or negligence was the sole proximate cause. Rather, the burden on the plaintiff is to show it is a proximate cause, that there may be, there often are, multiple causes of the plaintiff's injury. Yes, it may be true that this defendant's negligence caused the accident, and if we were picking, you know, which is the more significant, the more important cause, we might point to that. But if we look at the question of proximate cause with respect to did the abnormally dangerous activity cause the accident, we'd have to say, yes, it did. If this guy were carrying bananas, not gasoline, we wouldn't have had this conflagration and the injury to the plaintiff. So we can't really rely on proximate cause as a reason for refusing to impose strict liability in that case. What does Rossellini see in the doctrine of strict liability that would produce a different result in this case compared to the one we actually have? Attorney Gordon?
Would it result in a mitigation of damages due to contributory negligence?
Well, let's make sure we've got the... And I'm assuming that the person who's injured is not this guy. This is not the plaintiff here. But it is, you know, Carol House is over here minding her own business when she's caught in this fireball. Now, the term contributory negligence is a term of art. It doesn't simply mean, well, negligence that contributes to the accident. It has a very specific meaning, which essentially is the plaintiff's negligence. And as we've talked about before, the law has changed from a rule that treats the plaintiff's negligence as a bar to recovery. The modern rule is that it only reduces the plaintiff's recovery. But again, when we use that term, we're saying, in some respect, the plaintiff was negligent. And let's assume that we've got a situation where the plaintiff is not negligent. The shoemaker. Yeah. So, again, part of the reason that the majority wants to impose liability on the strict liability upon the carrier of gasoline is they have the ability to transfer this cost so that everybody who benefits from transporting gasoline pays incrementally for that privilege. And the cost of the periodic accidents that happen are not imposed upon the hapless victims who are in the wrong place at the wrong time. The people who benefit from it pay for it through the increased insurance or other mechanism to pay for these accidents. Does that apply any less if the accident is caused in part by a third party who gets in the way? Mr. Cleveland? Well, that's a very plausible thought that Rossellini is saying, in effect, if it's only the plaintiff vis-a-vis the carrier of gasoline, if we're saying to ourselves, let's assume, as in this case, the plaintiff is unable to prove the defendant was negligent, should we simply say to the plaintiff, well, I'm terribly sorry, but see, nobody was at fault, it's just an accident, you'll have to suffer your injury, the defendant can't be made to bear this loss. No, the majority says, because the defendant and the people who benefit from the defendant's activity get the benefit from this abnormally dangerous activity where nobody is at fault, they should pay. However, if somebody is at fault, this third party, then they are the logical party to pay. So for Rossellini, strict liability is kind of I don't know where else to go. If I don't impose strict liability, the plaintiff will have no remedy. But Rossellini says, where there's a third party who's at fault, we're not stuck in that situation. The plaintiff would have a remedy. And therefore, if it were up to me, I would limit strict liability to those cases where no one else caused the accident and the only avenue for recovery is through the application of strict liability. Now, it's unclear from the majority opinion what happens in a case like this, and it turns out that what most jurisdictions would do in a case where this guy's negligence and this guy's conducting the abnormally dangerous activity combined to produce the injury, the jury would be asked to allocate relative, what do we call it, fault? Not exactly, because the gasoline carrier is not at fault. They're being held strictly liable. Some jurisdictions use the term comparative responsibility, but that's kind of vague and amorphous. So again, the term that and we're getting into chapter 6 here, but just sort of by way of a preview, Chapter 6 is all about those cases where more than one defendant is found to have caused the injury, and we then have to allocate, well, how do we sort this out? Who pays what? What happens if one of them can't pay? What happens if one of them settles and the other one decides to go to trial? It sounds like a sort of a mundane mechanical thing, but it turns out to be a very significant issue in deciding whether the plaintiff can recover from the people that have the deep pocket. So again, the modern approach uses comparative fault, and as I think I said at the end of class, if these two things, negligence and strict liability, seem incompatible, like apples and oranges, we say to the jury, we'll make fruit salad out of it. Combine them in some way and say, how much of this accident should we attribute to the negligence of this driver? How much of this accident should we attribute to the abnormally dangerous character of the cargo that the other defendant was carrying? And whatever the jury decides, if it's 70-30 or 50-50 or 15-85, whatever that allocation, that's the way the damages will be imposed. Again, the majority doesn't really address this issue. Rossellini says in a case like that, in effect, I would make the allocation 0-100, take the party who's subject to strict liability out of it, not impose strict liability, and force the plaintiff to seek their recovery from the party who's negligent. And that leaves, of course, the possibility that this negligent party who causes a conflagration can't pay it all. And therefore, we would be stuck. Majority again leaves it open, and as it turns out, the law winds up more in this comparative fault dimension. Okay, any concluding questions about the application of abnormally dangerous activity? Mr. Middleton.
I was just wondering how the jury relates to the Alaska Airlines
Which are you referring to, one off of the Southern California coast?
Yeah, we're going right to be
There's a little bit of confusion here because we use that term, going back to Hammond Tree versus Jenner, we use the term strict liability to apply to a product case, product liability, but it's not exactly the same because the strict liability that's applied here says to the defendant who's carrying on an abnormally dangerous activity, you are responsible for the injuries that result from your activity. A company like Boeing that makes airplanes is liable if their plane turns out to be defective. And the only reason we call it strict liability is because there could be cases in which the defect in the product was not the result of negligence. It's rare, actually, but at least in theory, the defendant might be free of any negligence and nonetheless strictly liable because their product turned out to be defective. In most of the cases, the reason it's defective is because somebody was negligent. Somebody designed it without, you know, taking into account certain characteristics. Somebody made a part that wasn't up to standard, or there's some other failure of reasonable care. But again, the strict liability we impose upon Boeing is because the product turns out to be defective. And again, we'll take up all that stuff in Chapter 9. For our purpose, the thing that is similar is that you have the combination of Alaska Airlines negligent in their maintenance, Boeing liable because their product turns out to be defective. If that's the way the case is presented to the jury, they would have to make a similar allocation. How much of this is because Boeing didn't, you know, the the whatever the elevator mechanism or the thing that, that the stabilizer on the tail of the plane, that got the jack screw, or I forget the mechanism that caused this plane to crash, that was, you know, Boeing's liable because of some design or manufacturing flaw, but Alaska's liable because they negligently maintained it, didn't report or, you know, didn't pay attention to the problems they were observing with. Mr. Ortiz?
In that case, though, even if they took all the steps, like they did industry custom, followed all the regulations that the FAA has on, they still could be held liable.
Boeing could be held liable. No, Alaska is not subject to strict liability. Alaska is subject to a standard of reasonable care. Now, industry custom, government regulation, all of these things may be relevant to that. In fact, just to make life difficult, the issue of federal regulation in certain cases may be preemptive. That is, the government tells you, you must do this, this, and this. And in doing these things, the defendant may claim, in effect, we get a sort of immunity from that. Compliance with these mandatory government regulations removes the responsibility we have for making independent judgment. Those cases get kind of difficult, actually, the whole question. Because government regulation is so pervasive, where it's mandatory, where there are other things going on. But the standard for Alaska Airlines, there's no basis for holding Alaska Airlines strictly liable. They're only subject to a standard of reasonable care. The difficulty if you're Alaska Airlines, the reason that in virtually all airplane crash cases, they admit liability. The standard for running an airline is so high that it's pretty hard to say, well, we did all that's reasonably expected. These kind of crashes just happen, you know. So typically you find some error, some misjudgment along the way, and that's the basis for holding the airline accountable. Mr. Nelson?
In this particular theory here, wouldn't Rosalini be, in essence, saying that he's trying to do away with strict liability, that the driver would have to be negligent in some way in order for strict liability to come into play?
I'm not sure that follows. What makes you think that?
Well, he says here that where there's no outside force which causes the trailer to become detached from the trailer, the rule of strict liability should apply. But if there's some kind of outside force, then strict liability wouldn't apply because the driver didn't do anything wrong. Or is that bad logic to conclude that?
Well, Rosalini agrees that the driver of the truck, the owner of the truck, can be held strictly liable even though they do nothing wrong. That's the application of strict liability. And Rosalini agrees that in this case, strict liability should be applied. Where he gets off the trolley with respect to the majority is in saying, I would limit this rule to cases where no third party's negligence causes the injury. In such a case, I would expect the plaintiff to look to that third party and to that third party alone for recovery, and that the party who's conducting the activity subject to strict liability, the operator of the gasoline truck, would not be subject to strict liability. But the majority doesn't limit it in that way. The majority says, if you conduct this kind of activity, you are strictly liable for the harm you cause, irrespective of whether it's a deer or a negligent driver that causes the accident. Bradford?
What about the Bullock case where they were found because it was a...
Which Bullock, Adams? Bullock. Adams versus Bullock, yeah.
They were engaged in that normally dangerous behavior, I thought the court determined, but because the risk was unforeseeable, that they were not neither negligent nor liable?
I don't think that the opinion in Adams versus Bullock goes to the abnormally dangerous activity. They talk about the dangerous character of the activity, but they say in that case, in effect, the dangerous character is unavoidable. In fact, if Cardozo were asked to apply the restatement criteria, he might say, for example, that it's not uncommon, that it's not inappropriate, that it has high social value. He might say, from a public policy standpoint, I refuse to apply a rule of strict liability because I don't think it would be good public policy to hold trolley companies strictly liable.
I'm not quite sure what all the fun is about, but
Cardozo treated that case as though it were subject to a rule of negligence, and the plaintiff couldn't show negligence because however dangerous the activity might be, that danger was offset by the benefit to society and the cost of preventing accidents such as the one that happened to the boy would be unacceptably high. That's Cardozo's logic. Again, he's balancing these two things out. In a strict liability case, if you decide that it falls within these criteria, that it's abnormally dangerous, then you simply say, by conducting this activity, you accept the responsibility for paying for accidents caused by the activity, even though you've used reasonable care.
But after one accident, they know it's a risk, and if they don't take measures to, or precautionary measures to forego occurring accidents of such nature, could they then be held negligent or liable?
Only if you could show that the burden of preventing future accidents was acceptable in light of, you know, what would it cost to prevent future cases like the boy? Is it worth, and Cardozo sort of assumes it's not worth, in effect, foregoing the benefits of a live overhead wire? He doesn't have in mind, and there's no evidence, or we don't get it in the opinion. Maybe there was such testimony, but assuming there wasn't any testimony to the effect you could have an overhead trolley system and at the same time prevent accidents like this, Cardozo sort of assumes they're mutually incompatible. And he says, gee, the cost of that is simply unacceptably high. It's better for society, in effect, to have occasional accidents like this. A reasonable person would accept that as sort of a cost of doing business rather than say the trolley company is negligent, that a reasonable person would have prevented that. Cardozo says, I don't see where the evidence can be found that a reasonable person would have prevented it. Okay, now I want to shift gears from one theory of strict liability to another one. And interestingly, the case where we make this little pivot is a case relied upon in the previous case of Sigler versus Kuhlman. And Rylands versus Fletcher, in a sense, generated these two lines of descendants. One line of descendants is found in Sigler versus Kuhlman. A defendant who conducts an abnormally dangerous activity does so at his peril. But there's also a theory in Rylands versus Fletcher that has to do with what I call invasion of property rights, nuisance, other kinds of theories that allow the plaintiff to recover even though the plaintiff can't prove negligence. So let's get the facts of Rylands versus Fletcher on the table here, and then we can figure out what the legal argument was about. Ms. Carrier, why don't you tell us about Fletcher versus Rylands here?
Unbeknownst to your party, was apparently a coal mine, and the defendant hired engineers and contractors to survey his land flooding the reservoir, so that's the water escape through the workings of the coal mine, not because the embankment was high enough and therefore the plane was standing there.
Okay. So defendant has property, decides to build a reservoir, fill it up with water. His work, the workforce apparently becomes aware of these shafts as they're digging the reservoir, but that's never, he never finds out about it. And of course, one of the issues is he vicariously liable for their failure to put two and two together and to realize these shafts are, as they say, communicate with, are connected to the coal mine. Now, let's just sort of doing a little review there. Could the defendant be held vicariously liable for what his workers found out or should have known, should have recognized in digging this reservoir? Yes, that's right, as distinguished from employees. So if they work for him in a way, in a modern rule, where he could control the way they conduct their work, he had the right to control, then they are his employees. But if they are independent contractors using their own standards, not answering to him for the way in which they conduct their activity, then they are independent contractors and don't subject him to strict liability. Excuse me, don't subject him to vicarious liability. Okay, now the question is whether he should be subjected to strict liability. And what is the plaintiff's theory as to why strict liability applies?
Because a reservoir is contaminated with water. Can cause lots of damage to water itself. I guess it's sort of a, it's not really dangerous in and of itself, but if the water gets out, it can cause damage.
Okay, and this falls under the heading of the legal category we give to these things where you do something and it annoys your neighbor, it's a nuisance. Okay, so the plaintiff says, what you did as to me is a nuisance. And the law, everybody seems to agree, that with respect to establishing a nuisance, it's not my burden to show that the defendant was negligent, that his activity was not one that a reasonably prudent person would engage in, but rather, what's my burden to establish a nuisance? Okay, that it's a wrong thing to be doing. And classic examples of nuisance would be, you know, you've got a pig farm and the bad smells drift over, you don't maintain your septic or sewer system, you have some, a tannery or something else, and again, with modern law of nuisance, you can have all sorts of, your neighbors have wild parties till all hours of the night. Their cars parked higgledy-piggledy throughout the neighborhood. You say this is a nuisance. Okay. So the plaintiff alleges that the defendant's activity is a nuisance, and at first blush, what does the court say to that claim?
That the defendant's expert actually was the one who and the reservoir itself is the it's lawful to have a reservoir.
Yeah. That unlike, a pig farm or a place that makes noxious chemicals, a reservoir by itself, says the court, is not a nuisance. But there's a dissenting opinion here by Baron Bramwell, a character who will reappear, by the way, in later cases. What is Bramwell's opinion of the case?
That the plaintiff had a right to be free from pouring water, that the nuisance was not the reservoir itself, but the fact that the water was safe.
Yes, and of course when he's referring to foreign water, he's not referring to Avion or something else. He's referring to the fact that as to the plaintiff, again, the notion is that the plaintiff has a right to be free of being invaded by the defendant's activity. And that right is protected by the mechanism of strict liability. Rather than forcing the plaintiff to show that the escape of the water was due to some negligence on the defendant's part. But Bramwell loses that argument. He's a minority in the initial resolution of the case, and so the plaintiff has to appeal. And the notation of the case doesn't really tell you. It turns out that the initial case is tried before something called the Exchequer, the Court of the Exchequer. And Exchequer, you may know from English history, sort of like their tax authority. And the history of the development of English courts is full of all sorts of feudal, weird, historical anomalies. Courts had a kind of almost entrepreneurial quality where different courts asserted jurisdiction, the development of courts of law, courts of equity, that it's by itself a sort of a fascinating story about how the system that we now sort of take for granted grew, as I say, in many cases through historical accident. Okay, so it's appealed from the Court of the Exchequer to the Exchequer Chamber. They're the next stop in the food chain. And what does the Exchequer Chamber say?
That they delineate the Fletcher Doctrine, person covered on the purpose of his friend on his land, or anything like this existence, because they have taken a barrel for their purposes.
Okay, they think that Baron Bramwell had it right. Now, again, in the part that you just read from, there is, again, this is the branch of the family tree that leads to strict liability for an abnormally dangerous activity. One who keeps on his land something with this dangerous propensity, this dangerous potential, keeps that thing at his peril. Whether it's 10,000 gallons of gasoline or a dog or what have you, if it escapes, he becomes liable for it. But the court goes on in its opinion to explain, this is the reason why people keep reading Fletcher versus Rylands, Lowe, these many years later. It tries to articulate the difference between those kinds of cases governed by a rule of negligence and those cases governed by a rule of strict liability. What are the kinds of cases governed by a rule of negligence where the plaintiff can only recover if the plaintiff proves negligence? Ms. Jones? Sorry, a little louder. And where do we apply a rule like that? When is the defendant only subject to a rule of reasonable care, as distinguished from this case, where he keeps this quantity of water at his peril? But give me an example. What sorts of situations? What can the defendant do knowing that when I do this, I'm only held to a standard of reasonable care? Yeah, driving down the highway. In fact, that's the example they give. Someone who sets out on the highway does so not with the expectation that if someone causes my injury, I can recover on the basis of strict liability. I know when I set out on the highway that if I'm to recover for an injury I suffer, it will be only if I can prove that the person who caused my injury acted negligently. Why don't we apply that rule here? Mr. Gallard?
If they're on their own land, special rules apply because on his own respective property?
Yeah. There's a classic line. It's actually, I think it was Cardozo's line in a criminal case having to do with the right of self-defense and the rule of retreat. Ordinarily, in a criminal case, you're expected to retreat if you can do so safely and avoid a threat rather than standing your ground and using deadly force to repel the threat. But the rule of retreat doesn't apply in your own home. And Cardozo says, whither should he flee? You know, if you're in your own home threatened by the defendant's activity, you have a greater sort of a heightened expectation to be free of foreign water. Going out on the highway, you accept the risks, in part because, again, this idea of a non-reciprocal risk or of a reciprocal risk on the highway, I'm subjecting other people to risk. They're subjecting me to risk. The rule on the highway is essentially use reasonable care. But when you're sitting in your own coal mine, minding your own business, and somebody's foreign water comes flooding in, rather than being forced to show, but that guy was negligent, I enjoy this heightened protection to say, okay, it is my right to be free of foreign water. You are strictly liable. You keep that water at your peril. Okay, so here this area of nuisance, protecting a person's property rights, this case falls within the same area of strict liability as does the conducting of an abnormally dangerous activity. And again, to sort of give it a visual metaphor, you know, it's as though we have this ocean governed by the rule of reasonable care. Everywhere we look, we seem to find the standard of reasonable care being imposed. But there are these little islands here of strict liability. You know, this one for abnormally dangerous activities. And so the standard that's imposed is one of strict liability in those limited circumstances. You fall within that category, you get the benefit of that rule. So far, so good. Oh, now we got to get to the last part of the story, the third act of this play. Now it's the defendant who appeals. So the plaintiff lost the first round and appealed, but now the defendant lost the second round and the defendant appeals, and it goes up to the House of Lords. House of Lords, as you know, is sort of the equivalent of the United States Senate. That is, it's a smaller body, not the House of Commons. This is the House of Lords. That's essentially their Supreme Court. Imagine the United States Senate sitting as the Supreme Court. I would say that some senators think they are the Supreme Court, but I won't go there. So here we are in the House of Lords. The case has been appealed to them, and what do they say, adding to what has been said by the
Exchequer Chamber?
Well,
Lord,
the plaintiffs have taken measures to prevent the flooding, because that was a result of
the... Wait, run that by me again. Do we agree with the Exchequer Chamber, or do we disagree with them?
The first court, they agree with. They're overturning the second.
I don't think so. I think the House of Lords allows the decision for the plaintiff now.
Which is right.
I can't remember who's who here. I think Ryland's is the... yeah, they do switch parties here. But give me the rationale of the House of Lords opinion. What do they sort of add? What do they bring to the party here in terms of an analytical perspective? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Carey.
You're talking about the laws of nature.
Okay.
And how apparently you're supposed to make provisions to prevent the laws of nature from taking effect. That's part of your responsibility.
Well, I think what the House of Lords is saying is trying to identify what it is about what the defendant did that results in strict liability. Why is it that the defendant is properly subjected to strict liability? And it has to do with this distinction between what is natural and what is artificial. Why is that distinction important, Mr. Kendall?
If it was natural accumulation of the water and it got out and went to that point, then he probably wouldn't be able to be held strictly liable. But since he brought the reservoir upon his land, then the escape of that water would make him strictly liable.
Yes. Again, if the plaintiff's sitting in his coal mine, minding his own business, and a bunch of water from the defendant's land washes into it and wipes out his coal mine, the plaintiff can't say, hey, that water came from your land and caused my injury, if the water is simply there through natural processes. If it was, in effect, nature that caused this, the plaintiff has no beef with the defendant. The House of Lords makes it clear that because the defendant brought this artificial collection of water onto his land, that's what triggers strict liability. So it ties in, again, now we're reverting back to the abnormally dangerous activity thought, which is that somebody who does something sort of unusual, who changes the landscape, that person should think twice about doing it, because if it's of a particular kind of magnitude, they would do so at their peril. But strict liability doesn't apply simply because the defendant happened to be living on the land that the water ran through and caused his coal mine to flow. How those two things are related may be a very difficult factual case. So that people, for example, who develop property, you build a house on a hillside, you pave certain areas, and the people below you then experience a devastating flood, and they want to blame you, and you say, hey, look, what I did with my property didn't change, you know, the fact that I'm uphill and you're downhill. The water would have flooded your property in any event. Don't blame me, blame Mother Nature. Whereas the plaintiff may have experts who say, because you paved this whole area, water which would have, you know, naturally seeped into the ground, all that water was cascaded onto me. So again, in a particular case, you may have an important dispute over who, you know, did the defendant artificially change the amount of the path of the water, or was this simply following what had pre-existed? Mr. Rubio?
Just real quick, based on that, say for example the defendant, there was a lot of rain and a lot of water accumulated in the defendant's land. Let's say over a course of a week or so, the defendant knows that the water is there and does nothing to, say, remove it. Can he be held strictly liable?
Not if his role is purely passive. Again, the logic of the House of Lords opinion is those people who go out and do things, if it results in this damage to their neighbor's property, they do those things at their peril. But it's not that we expect you to be helpful to your neighbor if the thing that's accumulating is natural rainfall. Again, you may have a factual dispute in a particular case, but the principle is one they think is fairly clear. Now, we need to take a little break here in a minute, but what I want to set up for the next case is the question of how we apply this standard in the context of modern industrial life. So the plaintiff in Bohan lives next to this chemical or a gaslight factory. It generates these noxious fumes. The defendant says their activity is reasonable, necessary. It ought to be treated just like, you know, in Adams versus Bullock, the unfortunate danger of overhead wires, but look at how useful natural gas is to, or gas is to, lighting the whole city. And the question is, does the plaintiff have the burden of showing that the defendant was negligent, or can the plaintiff impose this principle of strict liability and say, it stinks? So, why don't we take a 10-minute break and we'll come back and pursue that.